From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, the George Zimmerman verdict and its takeaway for African-American teenagers in Milwaukee. Later, the relative harmony of one Milwaukee neighborhood.
If America looked like Sherman Park, we would be in a better place because it's the dynamic of people of multiple cultures, problem-solving, and creating really creative solutions.
We'll talk about a key figure in the immigration and labor spheres in Milwaukee. And novelist Jess Walter's characters are flawed, but he doesn't write them off.
And I think I have a fondness for my characters, too. I root for underdogs. I come from a small town and a very blue-collar background, and so I like people who rise to challenges.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. It remains unclear what, if anything, will happen next in the case of George Zimmerman. The Florida man was found not guilty of all charges last weekend in the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, an unarmed African-American teenager who Zimmerman confronted one evening as Martin walked home from a convenience store. The federal government is still weighing its options for a possible civil rights case. Here in Milwaukee, where race relations have often been contentious, people in the African-American community are discussing what the significance of the verdict is on a national scale. Daryl Williams is pastor at St. Mark African Methodist Episcopal Church in Milwaukee. Eric Vaughn is a former Milwaukee radio personality and a Lake Effect news analyst. They join us now to talk about the verdict and its aftermath. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Mitch.
Let's start with the George Zimmerman case and the death of Trayvon Martin. Do you feel like, was Trayvon Martin on trial as much as George Zimmerman was?
I think the entire African-American male community was on trial in this case. There's so many markers relative to this, to the trial and the entire prosecution of George Zimmerman that lead back to questions about African-American men as opposed to questions about many of the things that George Zimmerman brought to the case, his own desire to, quote, protect his community. What does that really mean?
What do you think it really means when he said, has said that?
Well, you know, the fact that you have a need for people to carry guns in neighborhood watch programs, to me, I think overstates the real danger in some communities. But that's the fear that people live with. And there are people who understand and share that fear that apparently George Zimmerman had. But to me, that's the issue more than anything else, that there are these people who feel justified in carrying weapons and they're willing to use them at any cost. Trayvon Martin and other young black males like him were on trial in this because America is constantly trying young black males just because they're here.
I agree. I think he was guilty of being black and simply walking through a neighborhood in which he had every right to do. So it really highlights racial profiling. Here's a young man, 17 years old, who had tea and Skittles and coming back from the store, and George Zimmerman saw him as a problem simply because he was black. And so it says a lot about how young African-American men are still viewed in this society. And it speaks to how we need to really get to know one another and get beyond our prejudices.
What's the message that you share with your congregation in the wake of something like this?
Well, again, for me, Sunday, it was all about the whole idea of racial profiling. It said to, and I have a number of African-American teenagers in the church, it really spoke loudly to them as to how they're viewed in society. And we've come a long way, but we still have a long way to go. And it's just really sad that this young man's life was taken simply because he was a young African-American male, again, guilty of nothing but simply walking through a neighborhood.
I think that a lot of people in – I think it's safe to say that many of the people in Pastor Darrell's congregation were not surprised at the outcome of the trial. They were not surprised at any of the things that went on in this. We've seen this and we have become accustomed to it, unfortunately, as we've watched cases unfold in this country time after time after time. So for the shock that some people seem to be experiencing over the outcome of this case, for most African Americans, it's kind of routine, or at least in our minds, we're thinking, you know, I think we'd have been more shocked had George Zimmerman been found guilty.
Absolutely.
Then, I mean, while it in our minds,
Absolutely.
Too, it would have been the right finding. I think we would have been surprised if this jury in that state where they support the stand your ground law, where people are allowed to do the things that George Zimmerman did to bring this whole thing about, we would have all been a bit more surprised at the outcome had he been found guilty.
Well, and so what is your take on this idea of the federal government potentially taking up a civil rights case against George Zimmerman? Is that the right next step in your eyes?
Well, I liken it to the O.J. Simpson case. I mean, if it was right for them to and for the families of the slain victims in the O.J. Simpson trial to have demanded civil justice in that case, I think the same rights should be extended to the family of Trayvon Martin. I don't think it should take demands by the NAACP and communities across the country being outraged at the findings in this case for there to be that kind of justice found for Trayvon Martin and his family.
At some level, is it possible to also look at this case as about Florida more than the rest of the country, or about this particular prosecution team versus anything else? I mean, at some level, is this about the unsuccessful strategy that the prosecution took?
Well, for me, I blogged on yesterday that George Zimmerman aside and the whole idea of racial profiling aside, I really didn't feel that the prosecution did a really good job of trying this case. The reason being is, for one, they changed their strategy in the middle of the trial. You know, they went in saying that I think it was Trayvon Martin on top. No, George Zimmerman on top of Trayvon Martin, and then in the middle of the trial, they changed it and said it was the other way around. When they did that, I was horrified. I said, "Okay, we're about to lose this case." So yeah, they did a poor job. But that aside, I still want to highlight the whole idea of racial profiling, the problem that it is in this country, and it's something that we need to continue to dialogue about and hopefully make some progress on.
What's interesting about this is that during the trial, it was clear, and the judge even made it clear to both sides, the defense and the prosecution, that race wasn't supposed to be an issue, which seemed absurd to me. This whole thing was based on race. This happened because of race. And for that element to be precluded in this case, and again, I'm not a lawyer, and I wasn't in the courtroom, so I don't know all the evidence. I know that as I watched some of this during the weeks on Court TV, there were what seemed to me to be critical moments that were where they took the sound out, where those of us watching on television couldn't hear what was being said, and some of those things were pretty volatile kinds of conversations that were happening in the courtroom around the evidence. And so for those of us watching in TV land, we don't really know what all of the evidence was, what the jury had to sift through, what the judge was allowing and not allowing. At least I don't know. So it's hard for me to say what the performance was of the prosecution. Obviously, if this is like some sporting event, you've got, you know, the victory goes to the defense. So obviously they played it a little better, it seems. Except that I think we can't overlook race in this. And I think that when you look at a jury that's constructed the way this jury was constructed, it's kind of – it's understandable why they came to this conclusion. I mean, again, if we get back to the issue of race, we get back to the issue of stereotyping and racial profiling that Pastor Darrell's been talking about, these women who were on the jury probably shared the same fears that George Zimmerman does Absolutely. Of black males. So to expect the outcome to be any different than it was, I think, was to have been living in some false world.
Well, and so let me ask you about this. The columnist Eugene Robinson wrote in the Washington Post on Monday that the case he saw was emblematic of a larger attitude towards black teenagers, that they are treated as menacing adults rather than children or teenagers. Are we at the point where African-American boys are not allowed to have an adolescence?
Well, I mean, I think, as we talked about earlier, I think that if you're a young black male, and I don't know that it stops at young black male, because I'm 55 and I've watched people on the street kind of cower at me. So it's not just being young and black. It's being black that is a threat to many people. But certainly young black males have a – I think there's a bigger fear factor involved with them than there might be with men the age of Pastor Darrell and myself. But, you know, I like it. I look at guys I play cards with. I play poker, right? And a lot of these young white guys I play poker with wear hoodies. So I don't even associate hoodies necessarily with black males, because most of the people I see wearing them are white males, and I'm not threatened by them. But I think that we have this stereotype in our mind of who wears what and who looks like what and who we ought to be fearful of. And I think it is unfair to young black males.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said something earlier, and I think that was right on, that Trayvon Martin actually was on trial. African-American teenagers were on trial. Unfortunately, they're guilty, and they have to prove their innocence.
What do you think the takeaway ought to be if you are a young black male in Milwaukee? What should you do with the information that George Zimmerman was found not guilty? How should it affect your life?
Well, I don't think that this trial sends any new messages to black people, black males, black females, black families. The kinds of warnings that parents give their children, black parents give their children, sons and daughters, have been pretty consistent for the last few decades. You know, you don't run from the cops. I mean, there was a document that the NAACP put out several years ago, that kind of gave you – it was kind of a blueprint for how to deal with police officers when you're stopped in the car. So certainly the only thing you might want to do now is – include in that with the police officers, folks who want to be police officers, people like George Zimmerman, who are acting as whether they are or not. If you know, you want to do what you have to do to make yourself as safe as possible. But again, those are not new rules in the black community.
And I would say my message would be stay out of trouble, because if you're guilty before you have done anything, imagine how hard it's going to be to get yourself out of trouble if you are guilty of something. Here you have a young man who was guilty of doing nothing but being black. And so never put yourself in a situation where you have to deal with the justice system, because the justice system already presumes you as guilty.
Well, Pastor Darrell Williams, Eric Vaughn, thank you both for spending some time with us.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Darrell Williams is pastor of St. Mark AME Church at 16th and Atkinson in Milwaukee. Eric Vaughn is a former Milwaukee radio host and an occasional Lake Effect news analyst. Keep listening. We'll talk about one Milwaukee neighborhood trying to get the diversity equation right when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee is one of, if not the most segregated city in the country, according to varying accounts. A report released last month by the Greater Milwaukee Foundation says the city is the most segregated among 15 similar areas, but the study also notes that Milwaukee is sixth out of those regions for diversity. While the city as a whole works to improve the mixing of cultures, there's one West Side neighborhood that stood out for such efforts for decades. Sherman Park, bordered by 35th and 6th 60th Streets and North Avenue and Capitol Drive has long been held as a beacon of racial diversity in the city, even if that is relative compared with the city's broad divide. Of course, this integration, however imperfect, did not come without challenges, a bit of serendipity, and a lot of hard work on the part of its residents. In the 1960s, as the city and country's racial tensions were running high, the neighborhood's residents began organizing and later turned the Sherman Park Community Association into a force to be reckoned with. Author Paul Geenan, a former Sherman Park resident himself, captures these stories in the new history of the neighborhood, Sherman Park, a legacy of diversity in Milwaukee. He explains to Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce what people think of when they consider this West Side neighborhood.
They think a neighborhood that has had a strong voice in what happens and very politically active. And they think of it as a diverse neighborhood. And they also see it as a neighborhood that's constantly under challenge, constantly dealing with problems and coming up with solutions that are from the community itself.
What set the stage? What was going on nationally and within Milwaukee that the Sherman Park, quote, pioneers, if you will, were responding to?
Well, in the 60s to the 70s, that was a time of great disruption in our communities. That was the Vietnam War. We had three assassinations, and there was a very, very lot of racial segregation going on at that time. And what was happening in Sherman Park was that, first of all, African-Americans were migrating to Milwaukee in huge numbers for the jobs. And they were being forced to live in crowded conditions in a very segregated part of Milwaukee. So there's this whole push. They wanted better housing. At the same time, in Sherman Park, there's a lot of redlining and real estate practices that tried to keep the area very, very white. And as African Americans started moving in, if one or two or three African Americans moved onto a block, then all of a sudden everybody in the whole block over a period of a couple of years would leave.
Right, that white flight.
There was a white flight. There was another big thing that was happening, that was the freeways were being built. And in 1964 was when the first freeways were built. By 1970, they had cleared the land from Sherman Boulevard all the way to the Marquette Interchange. And at that time, when land was allocated to freeways, it wasn't a very fair process. People were not notified of when hearings were held. It was closely held information where the center line of the freeway was, where it was going to be located. And it had tremendous impact on property values and not a good impact. It really – people, if your house was close to the freeway, you felt that your property values were decimated. So you had two factors that were forcing a lot of turnover in the Sherman Park neighborhood. So who moved in? Families, say mixed marriages, families that had adopted interracially, and white families that wanted to live in a multicultural environment, and African-American families who wanted to live where people were a little bit more open and amenable to living in a diverse environment.
So it's interesting to me then, how did these families, these pioneers moving into this neighborhood, how did they know that this was going to be a place where they could all live together? I mean, why didn't Sherman Park go the way that so many other neighborhoods did in Milwaukee and become very, very segregated?
Well, this wasn't a planned thing. I interviewed over 60 residents, and generally the story that they tell is I was driving down Sherman Boulevard and it took a left and I saw these wonderful elm trees and the houses looked beautiful and, man, this is where I wanted to live. It was a kind of a focus of people who were very active and involved, and then they attracted others. I might say that St. Catherine's was a real catalyst in Sherman Park. The Social Ministry Committee was the people on that. That actually started in 1965, although Sherman Park records say they started in 1970. But sometime in that period, you had a very active group of people at the St. Catherine's Social Ministry Committee. So they also recruited people to live in Sherman Park. So it was a combination of people stumbling on it and just being impressed by the wonderful values in the houses and people who came who were attracted to live with their friends.
from there, the Sherman Park Community Association was formed. How important was this organization in preserving that diversity and also fighting these issues?
Well, it was critical. The Sherman Park Community Association organized around housing, around the freeway, and around education. So those three issues, the schools, fighting the freeway, and fighting housing segregation, were critical, and the organization was key to making it happen.
Well, how did they defeat the freeway?
Well, that's an interesting story. First of all, it took 10 years. And you have to remember that most of the people in Milwaukee supported the freeways. There was a referendum that, and over 56% of the people said, yeah, it's a good idea. The key to defeating the freeway was that some professors at UWM uncovered the fact that they were designing the freeway to be of such scale so that during rush hour, people could travel at posted highway speeds. So when that fact became uncovered, and then people started saying, why are you tearing down my neighborhood just so you can drive in from the suburbs at 60 miles an hour, that turned things around. Then all of a sudden, public opinion shifted against the freeways. Another thing that was mentioned by one of the person I interviewed was that about the same time, people started looking at all the houses that were being taken off the tax rolls and started wondering if maybe this was not such a good idea.
I want to talk about that other element that the association and the neighborhood really worked toward, which was to get rid of housing segregation and housing discrimination. Tell us about some of the practices that realtors and real estate companies were using at that time to keep Black families from moving in. Did this happen in Sherman Park?
Yes, it did, and it happened a lot. The realtors would blanket an area with leaflets saying, we have a buyer for your house. And then sometimes in conversations, they would mention names of buyers that had very ethnic-sounding ring to them. And the whole idea was to frighten people to move. And it was totally illegal. But the Supreme Court finally, in the early 70s, said that housing testing was legal. It was proof that steering was occurring. And
now, what's steering?
Steering means that if you're white, they show you houses in a certain part of the neighborhood. If you're African American, they show you houses in another part of the neighborhood. One of my close friends, still to this day, he and his wife, they're a mixed couple, and he remembers how when he moved into Sherman Park, how the first house they bought, how he realized later that they were steered into an area that they probably wouldn't have bought in. They would have bought. They ended up moving just because of this practice of realtors deciding where you should live. So the Supreme Court ruled that you could do testing, and that's what really broke the back of that. And so the testing was what kind of turned things around.
Tell me about the testing. You have some great stories from people who actually participated in these tests and what they observed and ultimately were able to use in courts to reverse this practice.
Right. It was a process where hypothetical couples were created. So you'd have a white couple with a certain demographic and income and things like that. And they'd carry microphones, cassette tape recorders and microphones. And they would go and look at a house. 30 minutes later, another couple who would be African American or mixed, same demographic, same everything else, would go and look at the same house. And people who participated in that said this was a really, really a great experience. It was like the 60s. We were out there at the front. That was very exciting, covert. What was interesting was that people were discriminated against. They didn't even realize that they were being steered. It was only when you compared what the realtor said in one situation against the other that it became very clear that there was steering going on. One of my friends said that it upset her so much that she couldn't do it after a while. It just got under her skin. It was very disturbing.
How diverse then and how inclusive did Sherman Park become? Was there a lot of mixing between the races, or was it still pretty separated between the east side of Sherman Boulevard and the west side of Sherman Boulevard?
It was never perfect, and it's not perfect today. There was always meetings and conversations. There's a lot of anxiety over the fact that the eastern part of Sherman Park was very African-American while the western part was very white. And how can we make that? How can we fix that? And that never really did get resolved. There are today areas like, for example, Grand Boulevard, where I raised my kids, was very integrated when we lived there, which would be in the 70s and the 80s. Teague Willie Smith lives in Grand Boulevard today, and he says, you know, the area is starting to become very integrated. A nice mix of families are moving in, both black and white. So it's never perfect, but the goal is always out there.
What changed as we got into the 80s? What started to happen in Sherman Park?
Well, in the 80s, we had two things changed. One is drugs and one is the media. At least that's what I'm saying. In the 80s, the media started giving much more attention on a news broadcast to crime reporting. And there was a perception that crime had increased. Secondly, there was an actual physical peak of drug arrests in the 80s, about 1984 actually. But perception is reality, and there was this perception that crime was rampant and things were going to bad places. And so you had some people dealt with that different ways. Some people left, some people stayed, some people coped with it, and I kind of talk about that in my book.
And so then where is Sherman Park today?
Well, they're still out there. They're still working hard. I was at many of the meetings, particularly last fall, and I'm here to tell you that they're just as dedicated as they were 20, 30 years ago. The issues are different. They're working on different issues. And I also did find out that there's this whole faith community that is alive and well in Sherman Park. So you have these kind of communities within communities that are in Sherman Park today. My core point is that this is the way we think America should be. If America looked like Sherman Park, we would be in a better place because it's a dynamic of people of multiple cultures, problem solving, and creating really creative solutions is what we need here in the country. And we wish that the whole country looked like Sherman Park.
Well, Paul Geenan, thank you so much for coming in and giving us this little primer on Sherman Park.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Paul Geenan is author of Sherman Park, A Legacy of Diversity in Milwaukee. He's a former president of the Sherman Park Community Association. He's also a retired entrepreneur, grandfather, and community activist. And he's also written Schuster's and Gimbel's, Milwaukee's beloved department stores, and Milwaukee's Bronzeville, 1900 to 1950. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce. We'll take a break now and then shift to immigration reform and where it intersects with the labor movement. In Milwaukee, that intersection is represented by one key woman. We'll find out more when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke. The future of immigration reform at the federal level remains in doubt, stalled in the House of Representatives, where key Republican leaders oppose the package backed by the Senate. In Milwaukee, the issue of immigration is often linked to other issues such as the labor movement, a nexus at work in the labor unrest at Palermo's Pizza, in which some workers sought to organize and the company fired dozens, citing a lack of employment verification documents. The plight of the workers was taken up by a Milwaukee organization, Voces de la Frontera, and its founder, Christine Newman Ortiz. She's the subject of a profile in the current issue of Milwaukee Magazine by writer Kurt Chandler, who joins us to share his perspective in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mitch. It's great to be here.
What makes Christine Newman Ortiz a particularly compelling subject for you?
Well, I think she was almost born for the role that she occupies as executive director and founder of Voces de la Frontera. Her parents were immigrants. Her father was born and raised in Berlin as the Nazi Party was coming to power. Her mother was born in the Yucatan in Mexico, born into poverty. And both parents immigrated to the U.S. educated, grew into professional roles themselves, and became naturalized U.S. citizens. They traveled around before they settled in Milwaukee, where Christine's father teaches at UWM. And Christine herself was born in L.A., lived in Spain, Venezuela, Oregon, and Alabama. So she saw a lot as she was growing up. And as I say, she seems to be made for this role. As she was becoming educated, she went to UW-Madison, where she got an English degree, not the most marketable degree in the world. But she went on to study Chicano history at the University of Texas in Austin. And in doing research for her master's, she began working with a woman named Martha Ojeda, who was working with maquiladoras workers, who were primarily low-income, low-skilled young women who worked in the free zone along the border, south of the U.S.-Mexico border, in factories. Martha Ojeda organized these workers, and I think Numen Ortiz was inspired that, and essentially is doing the same thing.
I think you make the point that she seems almost born to play the exact same role here in Milwaukee.
Yeah. Ojeda was a role model to Numen Ortiz, and that's one thing she's doing as the director of Voces.
So what part of the region's Hispanic population do you see that that she especially connects with?
Well, I think the center itself is a service agency as well as an activist group. And as a service agency, they work a lot with non-English speaking, primarily Spanish speaking immigrants, many who are undocumented immigrants, who are trying to get a foothold in American society, who are trying to find work and possibly trying to find assistance. Because many are non-English speaking, the center provides them with services on how to, you know, become acclimated and how to find their way into the system. Along with that, she largely, Voces de la Frontera is an immigrants workers rights group. So they work on labor issues with people who are working or trying to find work, who maybe have been laid off, things like that. So I think that's a very necessary role in the mind of the Voces workers and certainly Christine Numen Ortiz.
And it also makes the organization distinct versus other Latino community organizations, right?
I found it curious in talking to some of those other agencies, some of those so-called legacy agencies, the long-established groups like the UCC, United Community Center, the Council for the Spanish Speaking, and UMOS. They at one time fulfilled that same role. They were working with undocumented workers. They were working with people trying to find jobs, people who had employment issues. And as they grew and I think became more established and maybe more tied to the traditional funding mechanisms that most nonprofits have to adhere to, they weren't able to be as take on as much of a role as an activist group would, such as Voces de la Frontera. And I've had people within the Latino community tell me that they see a niche for Voces because they can't do that kind of work anymore. They're sort of tied more to the political and fundraising establishment that goes along with being a big multi-million-dollar nonprofit.
Well, and you're right that that Voces has been particularly circumspect in terms of who it will accept money from.
Yeah, Christine told me they will not accept government grants or corporate grants. So they try to choose who their funders are and try to cut any ties to, you know, any political connections that might change the way they operate, change their tactics, change your strategy.
That comes at a price, though, because they clearly have not raised the same kind of money that these other community groups have.
Exactly. And they've taken a lot of criticism from some quarters on their tactics and their strategies, but they feel that they're independent and they feel that they are representing a certain segment within the community, really within the state. They've steeled themselves to that criticism that they've heard, particularly in the Palermo's Pizza labor dispute.
Well, right. And so let's talk about that, because you write a great deal about her and Vosa's work in the Palermo's labor situation. How do you see that as emblematic of the overall role that Vosa's de la Frontera plays?
Well, again, I think it was a classic immigrants' rights issue here. Palermo's Pizza has a long, storied history in Milwaukee. Jack and Zina Faluca came to Milwaukee from Palermo, Sicily, and grew a business here, started a bakery, started a restaurant on the east side, opened up a frozen pizza factory on the south side, and expanded to the Menominee River Valley. It was one of the first, if not the first, company business to build a new facility in the reinvigorated valley. So they won a lot of praise from the business community and elected officials for that. After they had opened, workers had some disagreements and issues with working conditions at the factory, and they contacted Voces de la Frontera, their service center, with some of these complaints. Cristina Newman Ortiz met with Palermo's several times on some of these issues to see if they could straighten things out or suggest some changes. But after a while, these complaints persisted, and they began talking about forming a labor union. And they started organizing clandestinely. They didn't want repercussions by the owners, by the managers. And it all sort of came to a head in May of 2012. But to answer your question, I think this is what they feel one of their key roles is. Others might disagree. Others might say they should just keep their nose out of labor disputes, out of union politics, and stick to immigration rights. But Christine says right from the start, they were a workers' rights group.
This is the nexus, really, between immigration reform and labor movements.
Yeah, exactly. And it makes for some strange bedfellows. And at the same time, it creates some conflict within those two groups, and as critics will say, it alienates parts of the community.
Right, and this is conflict with people who you might expect to be in league with Voces de la Frontera, people like Mayor Tom Barrett, for example, and Chris Abley.
Chris Abley, right. They, of course, as elected officials, welcome the growth of Palermo's Pizza and see any strong, harsh criticism being detrimental to that growth. So they take a bit of a standoff position when it comes to this labor dispute. I think it puts them in a corner, and they would rather not be in that corner, would they?
Well, and there are also some within Latino circles who have taken that same tack. The Hispanic Chamber of Commerce and at least one Hispanic newspaper have been at odds with Voces de la Frontera over the Palermo's issue.
Exactly. And you would expect the chamber to be, because the chamber often represents traditional business, even within the Hispanic community. Christine and her group take hits from a lot of areas.
But it seems like even so, there's a great deal of respect for her and the work that she is doing, even from some who would be critical of her particular stances.
Right. Within the Latino community, I heard that particular groups had nothing against Palermo's, and Palermo's it's actually quite responsive to the needs of the Latino community and helped out legacy groups such as the UCC. Yet at the same time, Ricardo Diaz, for example, the executive director of the UCC, says, you know, it's been a long time since there was a voice such as Voces representing the people in need, people who are Spanish-speaking immigrants.
And from here, even as the Palermo's situation moves towards a resolution to the degree that it's not resolved already, you would expect that Voces de la Frontera is going to be more and more wrapped up in the larger immigration reform efforts?
Depending on where that goes. Seems to be quite stalled at the moment, and not quite sure where that will lead over the next several months. I think that's just one of the fronts that Voces is involved with. Certainly immigration rights has been big. They've been arguing, demonstrating, holding protests on behalf of undocumented workers, on behalf of Mexican Americans, or Mexicans rather, who have been deported, which splits families. They've been very active on that front. Yet they also see a need to continue not only representing immigrant workers, but even pushing back at Palermo's, hoping for a better resolution than one that the federal government agencies have provided. Christine has said, you know, maybe someday in the future, they will try to organize again, try to organize workers again at Palermo's Pizza. And meanwhile, they keep the heat on, hoping that the workers' conditions there will improve. There have been some safety violations. There have been some complaints about discrimination, long hours. So these were issues that Voces hoped to work out through a labor union that they created, but it didn't turn out that way. They were repelled by Palermo's. And in this climate, in this day of anti-union sentiment, it's not much of a surprise. What I think is a surprise, or what can be counted on, is that Voces is not going away on issues of this sort.
Kurt Chandler, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch. Always good to be here.
Kurt Chandler is a Milwaukee area writer. His article in the July issue of Milwaukee Magazine profiles Voces de la Frontera founder Christine Newman Ortiz. You'll find a link to it from wuwm.com/lake effect. One last break, and then writer Jess Walter talks about the flawed but redeeming characters that populate his latest novel and much of his fiction. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. There is a review of Jess Walter's latest book that describes the author as, quote, a big-hearted man who excels at writing about other big-hearted, if broken, men. Walter would plead guilty as charged. The review is actually of his latest short story collection, but it could easily apply to his most recent novel as well. Beautiful Ruins is recently out in paperback and is filled with flawed characters who themselves are filled with humanity. The book brings together divergent characters, storylines, and even eras from World War II Italy to modern-day Hollywood. The tale is woven together convincingly and with good humor. Jess Walter joins us to share his own story now. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks, Mitch.
How would you describe the kind of characters that you're most drawn to, either the ones you most like to read about or the ones you most like to create?
I think I'm probably more drawn to flawed characters than I often have people say, you know, why are your characters so troubled? And they seem perfectly normal to me. So, but I think, like a lot of authors, I like to sort of work out existential questions and philosophical questions and psychological questions through the characters. So often they're troubled by things that work their way into the narrative.
They're troubled, but they're not. Sort of outrageously troubled. These are kind of normal, flawed people.
Yeah, and I think I have a fondness for my characters, too. I root for underdogs. I come from a small town and a very blue-collar background, and so I like people who rise to challenges. To me, a father who, is homeless and has to beg for money to buy his son in foster care a present is more interesting than, a wealthy lawyer who comes home from the golf course and finds out his son has gotten into Yale. I'll just always be drawn to those harder cases, probably.
Well, and it's funny because we might think of the latter case, the father who comes back home the lawyer father, whatever, as being kind of the larger character. But the larger than life people are the ones who you really kind of get into.
Yeah, I like people who face all sorts of challenges. And in Beautiful Ruins, for instance, I think a lot of the challenges are created by the characters themselves, by their own appetites and their ambitions and their dreams. And those kind of characters really inspire me. But also, just coming from the background I do, I'm really inspired by people who have economic hardship, who don't have the advantages that some other characters do.
There are any number of big-hearted and or broken characters in the book, some beautiful ruins, you will. When you go back to the beginning of the process, what was the ruin that first got lodged in your head? Or do you even work that way?
I really don't work that way. I, for me, fiction is a series of holes that kind of open up. I start digging around. And the very first image I had is the image that starts the book, which is a woman arriving in this Italian village that you can only reach by boat. And for a couple of years, I didn't know who these people were. I just knew that she was beautiful and he was smitten. And those characters, Dee Murray, an actress who's been exiled from the set of the film Cleopatra, and Pasquale Tursi, this Italian innkeeper, were the real constants for the book. Finding out who those people are, you dig and dig, and the more you get to know them, you realize the sort of question that their lives pose. And the novel ventures over a bunch of different characters. It has real breadth as you meet all these people who connect to their lives in certain ways. But at the heart of it was always those two people, Pasquale and Dee, and their and the idea that the moment where they met would be so powerful for both of them that it would define their lives.
It's fortunate you were a fiction writer, because that could easily have been the setup for a perfume commercial.
Yeah, well, it wasn't. It was, yeah, no, I was always interested in the difference between the vision of the life that you imagine, the dream, and the life that you end up living. There's a moment where Pasquale realizes that his life now will always be two lives, the one that he leads and the one that he doesn't. And those roads not taken, the idea of regret. And when the title Beautiful Ruins hit me, I realized that there was a sort of dignity and power and honor to the life that you choose, even if it isn't the dream that you imagined in the beginning. And that's what I was really writing toward.
Well, and regret really underlies almost everyone in this book.
I think it underlies everyone in life. You know, I don't, you know, I'm not playing in the NBA as I had hoped when I was 9 years old. So, I think for a lot of us, coming to terms with the sacrifices we make, the decisions we make, I started this book in 1997, and I lost a parent and had a couple of children and had one move out of the house, and you experience that much sort of life and heartache and also the sort of everyday triumph, and that's what I wanted the characters to sort of experience. And so I think this book probably has more breadth and more of a longer tail than most of the books I've written, because that's what the characters experience.
This might be one of those things that I may just be ascribing more significance to it than anything, but there is something almost poetic in so much regret playing out in places that are so sun-drenched and so physically beautiful. A lot of this book takes place in the seaside village in Italy. Some of it takes place in California. These are places where externally everything kind of goes with a veneer of beauty.
Yeah, no, I think that's perceptive. It's very much, you know, the settings of had a sort of romanticism that I wanted to explore, even though I think of myself as a kind of anti-romantic in a way. And the book is very much about our romantic ideal of the places and the people. So it begins in this village, Porto Vergogna, in the part of Italy called the Cinque Terre, the Five Lands, that is these villages etched into the cliffs, fishing village that I invented. And then it moves to Hollywood, you know, another a place that connects, of course, with dreams, because it's where they all go. And it moves to Edinburgh, Scotland, and, a mountain resort in North Idaho, and it really sort of hopscotches the world.
You kind of alluded to this, as I read the book, one of the issues that stuck with me is that the characters who populate it, you have an innkeeper in this tiny village, you have sort of a failed writer from Wisconsin, a film producer, a movie mogul, a would-be screenwriter, a 1960s movie star, and a struggling rock musician. It is no small accomplishment that you were able to weave their lives together.
Yeah. Again, it's sometimes when I'll try to explain a book, I'll feel like, you know, there should be congressional hearings or something. I should have a lawyer whispering in my ear. On the advice of counsel, I can't answer that, because it's almost impossible to defend the choices you make. I found myself inventing this actress, and she was in Italy in 1962, and I thought, what's she doing in Italy in 1962? And that leads me to research Cleopatra, the film that was being made there. And I think, you know, I always was trying to find characters that who were striving in certain ways. And, you know, one thing would lead to another. One bit of research would lead to the next. I think one of the reasons the book took so long was weaving all those stories together. I always thought of it as a sort of braided story, these strands coming in and out but hopefully forming a whole, and that whole being a kind of, a story that about not just the people in their lives but about a kind of thematic connection that they all have too.
There is one of the characters in Beautiful Ruins, Alvis Bender, who has been coming to this little seaside village in Italy for years to write, but he has only ever written a single chapter of this would-be masterpiece in his mind.
Yeah.
Was there a point at which that was – Beautiful Ruins was that book in your mind?
Yeah, that's an illustration of kind of how the book worked for me, exactly. I was stuck with one chapter just as Alvis Bender is stuck with one chapter. I had two problems, really. I had in my mind the idea that this villa, that this hotel should be called the Hotel Adequate View, which struck me as funny but also sort of wistful, and I'm a pretty wistful writer. So the other problem was that I was stuck with one chapter, a woman checking into the Hotel Adequate View in a village I'd made up in Italy. And if you know anything about Italians, you know that understatement is not a hallmark of especially Italian males. So trying to figure out how this innkeeper had named his hotel the Hotel Adequate View, I realized I needed an American. And so being stuck on one chapter, I sent an American with the problem I'd had, which was that he was Alvis Bender, a former Wisconsin car salesman and English teacher who – which sometimes feels like the cross of a novelist is half car salesman, half English teacher. So I sent Alvis Bender to solve my narrative problems. And along the way, I was in Scotland for the Edinburgh Fringe and Book Festival and found myself contemplating questions of beauty and art that, that the character Pat later contemplate. So in a way, because the book took those 15 years, I very much found myself incorporating my own writing life into it.
As it existed as a single chapter for so long, how did you come to the conclusion that it was a novel and not a short story?
Well, every time I would return to it, I would tear it down from the beginning. There isn't a sentence that existed as it did then. But as with most people, I think for a fiction writer, the elemental thing, the thing at the very beginning is character. And these people, Dee and Pasquale, especially Pasquale, who was lived in this small provincial town and dreamed of turning a small fishing village into a resort teeming with Americans and Canadians and Marilyn Monroe on his beach, and him dumping loads of construction sand and having the waves take them away and imagining he could build a tennis court in the cliffs until Dee points out to him that the tennis balls will be bobbing in the ocean if people miss them. And that sort of dreamer, that unlikely dreamer I connected with, again, coming from Spokane, Washington, I still live in the town I was born in. And so Pasquale, someone who believes life is going to pass him over, was a character that I just couldn't let go of. And so every time I finished five other novels in those 15 years, and every time I finished one, I would say, all right, what other arrows do I have in the quiver? And I would always find myself returning to a book that was called at various times The Hotel Adequate View and all sorts of things before it became Beautiful Ruins.
Well, it's terrific stuff. Jess Walter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jess Walter's latest novel is called Beautiful Ruins. It is just out in paperback. He also has a recent short story collection called We Live in Water. Walter lives in Spokane, Washington. We spoke with him before a reading in Milwaukee in May. That's Wednesday's Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the program, the global importance of Nelson Mandela, honored in Milwaukee on Mandela's 95th birthday. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.